Hey fellow listeners, welcome to the Intellectual Masturbation Podcast. This is the second part of our discussion about the film Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. So please do check out the part one before continuing over here. Most of the film and most of the scenes, most beautiful scenes are shot actually spontaneously. For example, yeah. That whole elephant parade thing which is happening, that's quite an adorable scene if you look at it. Uh-huh. But apparently they got to know that there was an elephant parade going on and they suddenly went there and shot it.
Yeah.
And also the flea market fight and everything.
Yeah. I mean, that is what makes it look more natural, like more of like a relationship where it's the fight spontaneously starts. They're just looking around at like the flea market and small babies, and suddenly they get into a fight.
Yeah.
Where they have this feeling of, you know, leaving each other or being like, oh, this is finally. And like in the middle of it itself, Joel is like, oh, I'm glad this is being erased. And the next moment he's unhappy. No, I don't want this to be erased. Like he realizes that the good memories also go with it, which he wants to hold on to.
See, this is the thing with memories, and like, I believe memories are what you're made of. And like, you can't escape them no matter how good and bad they are. So in a way, this man like just going onto the lake and like shouting that I don't want them to remove it tells this man, like, because you learn a lot of things, you are made of them literally. If you ask, if you question yourself about your life and what you're doing, who were you yesterday, it were all your memories. So you are nothing without them.
Yeah, and there is like that whole, phrase or idiom that we all listen to, like ignorance is bliss or forgetting is bliss and things like that. But even though it's a well-established phrase, we always think, right, like we are made up of all the lessons we learn from our mistakes or we cherish our good times. And it's not like, we were talking about that, how the title came by, the Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. Spots are needed to, you know, make your life full. It cannot be spotless.
Yeah.
So, I would love to know what you have to say about the title and how it was taken, what it was taken from.
This title, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, is taken by this work by Alexander Pope, who is a romantic poet. It's called Eloisa and Two Abelard. It is about two lovers. Again, like it's the typical star-crossed lovers kind of a romance. So the story goes like this, and like Eloisa is Abelard's student, and I think Abelard is a teacher who came to teach, and like they both fall in love, and they have this huge age gap in between them, and also things like society, and this girl is just like 16 or something when this whole relationship thing is going on, and like they get separated. And these both are like very famous lovers, and like both of them, like this whole love story between them. These are like the real star-crossed lovers trope, and like bringing them and superimposing them on modern relationships is a clever choice actually. Both of them like go on like hand in hand with each other, and after that they are like divided into this, and the whole modern saga follows.
Yeah, from what I read on, say, Abelard's decisions, right? Like, they decide to separate and live their own lives, where he goes and becomes a monk, and she continues to become a nun, even though she didn't want to. But she was like, yes, if Abelard is doing that, I'll be doing this, is what they decided. So, I mean, with respect to how the whole teacher-student aspect of this relationship came by, a lot of concerns are raised, like, in the present cultural space where, you know, a lot of grooming happens when there's such a huge age gap, or say there's a gap in experience in between relationships. And like one of the correlations I would draw to our film,
it would be between Mary and Howard.
Exactly, correct. Like the character of Mary is someone where, you know, they both decide, eventually we come to know about how Mary had gone with the process in the beginning things, right? Like, I feel she's a very important character in the movie. It's a storyline and the background that is simmering throughout the movie. And Mary's character is the one that in the beginning is like, oh, Howard is the best person. He's the one providing, you know,
you can
solutions
see, like,
to sadness.
It won't feel like, you know, there is a probable underlying relationship between them and something. But you can see always her trying to be intelligent in front of him and dropping
yeah.
hints at him. You can always see him, like, she quotes Nietzsche to him, like, and says
yeah.
things like, you know, blessed are the forgetful, for they get bitter even out of their blunders.
And she would wonder whether you know, the doctor would like it,
yeah.
whether he would appreciate that, whether it's there in his code book and things like that. So we see that in a lot of dialogues that Mary has got, although they're very few, I think they are very significant for the movie in the
yeah.
sense that there was one scene where Joel comes in to get his memory erased, and she's talking to someone in the reception desk where she's on the phone and telling that you can't get this procedure done like thrice
a month, yeah.
Time period and things like that. And that kind of sets the precedent to the movie plot where, okay, maybe the procedure fails, or maybe the procedure can't be done for different people that you fall in love with. And it questions the procedure's validity, right?
Yeah.
And I think that is important because it kind of justifies eventually how do they come back together, or do they separate their ways, or how did they meet in Montauk Station at the same day and the same time and things like that. I mean, of course, it's well established that Montauk is a faraway station, so there are fewer trains, so there's only one or two trains that goes there, and that is all established in the visuals of the film. But then how do they go at the same time, right? That is where it goes, like you said, it becomes a full circle.
Yeah.
Because there's a promise that gets fulfilled, that she says, meet me in Montauk, in the dream sequence kind of a situation. And
also, like, Mary is the character, I believe, who delivers these lines of Pope.
Mm-hmm.
How happy is the
yes.
blameless vestal's lot, the world forgetting by the world forgot. Eternal
yeah.
sunshine of the spotless mind, each prayer accepted and each wish resigned.
Yes.
Like, in a way, she is like, you know, trying to forget about his,
mm-hmm.
About her relationship with Howard.
Yeah.
And the procedure, maybe, like, she might have undergone it multiple times by herself too.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
it depends
and
on you totally, like, how quickly you fall in love with someone and, like, how quickly you want the procedure. If there is a
yeah.
drug which is available in the market with which you can erase your memory.
Yeah.
How many people will be in the line? I'll be the first.
Yeah. And so many selective, like, the option of that in the movie was selective memory, not that you forget
yeah.
the whole time period. It's like they are selectively removing what period, part and period you don't like. I mean, that is a very niche concept, you know.
Yeah.
And so it's like Mary in the beginning, not knowing that she's gone through the procedure, thinks that, oh, Howard is saving people's sadness, and he's bringing people out of the sadness. And when she realizes the reality that, oh, she is the one who has gone through, you know, the whole concept of, like, the whole reality comes in picture that she doesn't like it anymore, that she's gone through it. And she takes
yeah.
that drastic step of telling everyone, you know, and she's taking the tapes and she's like, I'm going to tell people because they deserve to know. So there's one line in the beginning of the film that Joel says that, you know, how Valentine's Day is something where corporates and companies profit off of people's sadness and things like that. You know, out of people's vulnerabilities. And this is exactly what pans out in the film through Mary's character, that she was fine with it as long as it was, you know, work for her.
Yeah.
But when she realized that it is herself going through that whole process, she was not that comfortable with the idea of it.
And also,
you
she
know?
Says that, you know, it's a Valentine's Day time, we are almost full, you can't get in right
yeah.
now.
Yeah, exactly,
yeah.
exactly. So I think that goes very well with the title and the story of the lovers. And this is like a background story to go with, right? Like every
yeah.
gap that Joel and Clementine's story has, it's kind of filled in with the dialogues and the story from Howard and Mary's situation, you know?
Yeah.
And even how Stan and Patrick, the friends who are doing the memory erasure in the beginning, they are key components to Joel and Clementine's story, like Patrick coming in between that.
Also,
and
there are these, I think, other couples, like the friends of this guy, Joel, And if you look at Patrick and Tangerine, that is the, I don't know, Clementine's alter ego or something.
Yeah.
And like Mary and Stan, for example. Like, you look at these different kinds of couples, you know, like this guy, Patrick, is just trying to create love in between him and Tangerine. And like Mary and Stan are just this co-workers who are like friends, but more than friends.
Yeah.
And Howard and Mary and Howard's troubled relationship with his wife. It is like juxtaposing all these couples and Joel and Clementine.
Yes, definitely. And you can see it in, say, Stan's discomfort where he knows the, or if, I don't know, he has some idea about Stan. Like, Stan has some idea about Mary feeling way too much for the doctor, right? And we are also confused at the same time. So in the beginning, we're confused as confused for Stan that, oh, like he's just jealous of her having so much to look up to the doctor.
Yeah.
But then we later realize that, oh no, it was actually the, you know, situation where she was in love with him. And even when Dr. Howard comes into Joel's house to see the problem that takes place, very naturally Mary goes to him and Mary is like, I kissed you, and then she feels guilty about it.
Yeah.
You know, that is where I would like to highlight this whole aspect of grooming comes into picture, where, you know, Howard knew what happened was actually from a very previous, you know, set story of them always being in love together, and then they both decided to erase her memory. Because Howard probably knew that he could control himself, right? And that doesn't happen or things like that. And then Howard is the one who explains it to her because his wife prompts him to do so, that, you know, please tell the girl the truth already.
There is also a lot of, you know, reading in between the lines we need to do in terms of this film especially. Like, when, like, Joel says to this Clementine, constantly talking isn't necessarily communicating.
Yes. I would say that is one of my favorite dialogues. Yeah. Like, because I'm so conflicted with it.
And also, even Mary says things like, you know, adults are like this mess of sadness and phobias. In a way, it is like related to the relationship like she is having, and also like the relationship of the lead. Yeah, the childhood part of them, like the running away, the whole chase thing. We'll talk about that.
Yes.
I think that would be interesting. You know, when this, when suddenly in one of these dream sequences by Joel, he's like dragging Clementine off the platform. And she's like, you know, like, leave my hand. Let me go. Just let me go.
Yeah.
If you look, like, if you read in between lines, she's asking her, like, him to let go her of his memories, literally.
Yeah.
And, like, they're running from the platform and this whole thing happens. And, like, suddenly, because they're tracking every place this guy shares with Clem, and every object this guy shared with Clem, and like they're tracking. Now he wants to take her to an unfamiliar territory. That now obviously becomes their childhood. And in a way, you get an answer to why Joel is like this also. You see this guy getting bullied as a child to kill that bird, and like, this man, like, and this girl comes and saves him. Maybe, you know, it is that girl was really there in his childhood, actually. And now he is, like, imposing, like, Clementine and imagining her as that particular person. Okay, what if Clementine was this girl who shared with my childhood? Because obviously, both of them clearly had never had a conversation about this guy's childhood. Your formative years, I believe, are the most important in what makes you as a person. So when you're getting to know each other as like two different people, obviously there will be a talk about this, or some people are like rather like private and they are like, you know, like, you just know me from the point I chose to tell you from my life. So suddenly both of them go to this unfamiliar territory. And they slightly enjoy each other's company over there, actually.
Correct.
Yeah.
I mean, you can see how probably they, during the relationship, discussed all the good childhood memories, right?
So maybe.
The selection of memories that Joel has, they're all these moments of say fear and bullying and embarrassment.
Yeah, like pure embarrassment. Also, like, yes. You know, how many embarrassments do you share with your partner or someone?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think so this is the, in a way, this is the fun part of relationships, you know, getting to know each other, like, in that whole honeymoon phase.
And I feel like after this, like, this exercise that took place in Joel's head, that's when we can hope. Like, the end question is that, like, do they end up with each other or are they the same people and things like that? Did they learn anything from this exercise? Yeah. I think this moment is very defining for that, that they did, like, see, we can talk about Joel. Like, yes, Joel did learn that, okay, constantly talking is not necessarily communicating.
Mm-hmm.
He kind of learned that maybe, you know what, maybe I could have communicated more and both of us could have understood each other better. And, you know, the surface level relationship could have been a little bit more deeper,
or probably, you know, both of them could have enjoyed it while it lasted than thinking about things which are, like, you know, intangible. This reminds me of, you know, this whole childhood sequence and everything. This reminds me of something I've read. It's by this author called A.K. Ramanujan, and this poem is titled as Love Poem for a Wife. The first line of it reads, you know, really what keeps us apart at the end of years of unshared childhood. Yeah, like them telling each other or them taking them into each other's childhood is a really great part, I feel.
And that is in a good way. Like, we were even talking about how Joel keeps saying that, you know, I'm probably the nicest guy that she's been out with, and that he's surprised that why would she go and, you know, do something like this. And one of the main reasons, you would say, is in the one of the initial scenes where he says, "Oh, this is the last time I saw you." They have a fight about why she's come back home late, and he kind of comments on how she sleeps around with people to make them fall in love. And she kind of gets close, you know, she gets very offended by that, and she's like, "Hey, this is something I cannot take anymore." And that is what makes her choose that option, that I will be the one doing this procedure. And one of the reasons that Joel does the procedure is like, hey, I'm the nicest guy and still she did this to me. You know what? I'm also going to do this.
Okay, this is where I'd like to bring in Naomi, actually. Because I believe, again, like, the character of Naomi is edited out, and like, there are many things, but it is there in the script. So I believe over here, this man is insecure because he kind of did Naomi for this girl, this so-called manic pixie dream girl he has met.
And that's the pressure they put on the partner, right?
Come on, like, you're here and my life is still the same. What are you doing? My life, kind of a pressure. I think Clem describes at the bookshop when she, like...
Same, I was going to point that out. Like, she tells it herself that, hey, I'm not here to save you. I have my own thing and I have my thing going on. And he gets that as well, right? So... in a way, both of them have that understanding present in that scene where, you know what, I like we said, like, a lot of people categorize this movie as, hey, this is too dumb, or some people say, hey, this is too complex, and I was like,
people who say, you know, like, they are afraid of watching films like this. I get it, but I don't know, man, like, probably if you watch this film, it won't be that bad.
Yeah,
maybe whatever makes you say this thing, you know, this film will soothe you down rather than, you know, paining you or pricking you again. In a way,
it goes on with how relatable the film is.
Yeah, like, this film is a therapy, man.
Oh, I completely agree.
This film is a therapy. That's it.
Yeah.
So, there have been a lot of things told about Clem's hair color and everything. But in a way, what really, like, adds to the script, or what is really highlighted by this girl's hair color, is the seasons.
Yeah.
The seasons they are in, literally. When, like, Clem meets him at the starting of the film, it is like this, on this wintry morning. And this whole winter thing is going on. Like, it has always been symbolic of death and things like that, where things will end. Usually things will end in winter. But it is also the season of this hibernation. after winter, when the sunlight melts the snow away, the new sprouted like grass comes out, literally.
Yeah.
And maybe it is just what is the case with these guys' relationship. Maybe just they are like a couple who are bored of themselves, and maybe they just need some rejuvenation. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
I believe it is still going to be, even after this point of realization, there is no over-dramatic ending and promises of being there with each other till the end of their life and something like that. Maybe it is a repetitive cycle for both of them.
Yeah, but I feel like they're more grounded in this manner. Right?
Now they have
after
understood
the hibernation period.
Now they have understood it that, you know, itna hi hota hai.
Correct.
Yeah.
And if you go to see, like you said, the season, it is very important, because how many, it's like a memory flashback, right? Like they're going through memories. So it's almost like the timeline of the relationship is showcased in a reverse manner in the book.
Yeah.
So I always tell, if I'm discussing this with someone, I tell them that, you know what, just if we have to understand the relationship, you have to just watch the movie, you know, in reverse, and just they are parts, like the parts of the relationship.
Yeah.
That is like the timeline that they went through, and you will understand how the relationship and the color theory of the film is like the relationship when it was new and happy and exciting, the warm colors were there, and eventually when it comes to it, it's dark and, you know, dense where the reality is in question.
When he's like running away with Clem, Clem's hairstyle, like hair color is red. It is full red when he is in his childhood experiences.
Yes.
That shows that, you know, like how much of love he has for Clementine, I believe.
Yes. Just,
and also it is a callback to the most like, you know, lovable period in there, like the post-honeymoon period. Like almost, it reminds me of a poem by Robert Browning. It says, "Oh, my love's like a red rose that's newly sprung in June."
Okay.
Yeah, so that summer season of their love story is there.
Yeah, highlighted.
Yeah, very highlighted. And like, they are this really happy couple and everything.
Mm.
And also like this, the blue Clementine and this whole starting part of the film.
Mm.
Like, it's in a way like a callback to, okay, they are in the winters of their relationship.
Mm.
But, you know, like, when winter comes, can spring be far behind?
Yeah, I mean, in the blue hair Clementine version, right?
Yeah.
I feel the reality of her character is really shown in the sense that the bookshelf, Barnes & Noble's bookshelf scene, if you go to see, because it's a erasing phase or say something like that, the background of the film, even the dialogues are the most real ones that are out there. Like, he realizes that she's not the one who's going to come and save his life things like that. The, if you see the bookshelves, the books are disappearing, everything is fading
and
off.
And it is turned white, almost.
Yes, exactly. And I mean, I would say, like, even though the most real dialogues are told in that period, it's like I'm very scared to go through it because of the disappearing bookshelf, you know?
Yeah.
It's haunting. It's like it's haunting to face the reality because of how they've shown the visuals in it. So, I mean, that's where the Manifixi Dream Girl trope is dismantled, I would say.
And even with this dialogues by Clementine saying this, you know, like, many guys think I'm a concept or something. I'm just a fucked up girl looking for my own peace of mind. I think at the end of it, you know, it is just you being with someone else and, you know, both of you keeping each other's peace of mind.
Yeah, exactly. Like I said, it makes them more grounded once they know all of it.
Even though it is the most romantic film I have seen, it tackles all the romanticism from the romance.
Exactly. I mean, it brings you closer to reality, right? Like, it's not some haywire concept that only, you know, only see. It's not like only seen in movies, right?
Yeah.
It feels so real because of how...
So it also tells you why this romanticism is important in your life. And also why a reality check is also what you need. It balances both of them, like, you know, like pitch perfect manner.
I get it. I completely agree. And that's why I don't want to, you know, fixate it onto a category. Like,
yeah.
You know, best or worst and things like that. It's more like it's real while it's showing the absurdity of it.
So you have any closing remarks?
I mean, for someone who hasn't watched this movie, I would be like, yes, watch it for sure whenever you get to watch it. But then if you get a time, you should watch it again if you have had a bad breakup or if you're in a new relationship and things like that. You know, like I said, I always have like a different way to, you know, feel the movie whenever I watch it in a different phase of my life.
Yeah.
So that is something I would tell if I'm recommending it to anyone. What about you?
So, you know, if anyone has heard podcast till now, I think your myths have been busted. Your bubbles have been busted. And you will get back to reality and like you will start loving this film and loving your life. I think that is it. So thank you for joining me. It has been a long pending this thing to discuss this particular film with you.
Yeah. Thank you for having me though, because I really wanted to do this. I mean even I like this movie and every discussion around it is warms my heart up.
Yeah, even like so hopefully we'll continue this. And you'll keep coming for more episodes and we'll discuss more films or books. Thank you.
Yes, definitely. Thank you.
Well, that's it for today's episode, guys. Thank you for listening. Before you guys leave, I have a small request to make. We have started a budding cinephile community on Instagram. We are there on Instagram @classics_covered. There are a lot of visual details you miss out on this podcast, and I want to share those short scenes and everything on my Instagram page. So if you guys don't want to miss out on them, make sure you follow us. I hope to see you guys over there. Thank you.